అలీమామే మనస్తో మనంబునామే అలీ. مدار جان گرامی فدائے نام علی.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is the universal aspect of his personality. Whoever, from whatever religion or nationality, studies the life of Ali, one of the first things he will come to realize is this universality of the personality of Ali bin Abi Talib. There are many, many examples where a person by the name of Michael Naima, a Lebanese Christian who wrote a preface to the book of George Jordaq, who was a Christian, although now they are saying he became a Shia now, but we are talking about 50s. He wrote the book. The book was published in 1958. And so at that time, Michael Naima was a writer himself. Jordaq was a writer also. And Michael Naima wrote the preface to the book of George Jordaq, which is known as Al-Imam Ali, Sawt al-Adalat al-Insaniya, where he talks about Imam Ali as the voice of human justice. Michael Naima, in his preface, says something very interesting, and let me quote this paragraph from him. He says, Ali was born in the Arabian land, but he is not confined to the Arabs. So there is no geographical limitation to his personality. Although Islam brought forth the fountains of his blessings, he does not belong to Muslims only. He says, yes, Ali came in that, you know, context of Islam. Islam was the basis for it. But you cannot say he is only for Muslims. And then he relates to this book that he wrote the preface for. He said, if he had been for the Muslims only, how could his noble life captivate the soul of a Christian writer in Lebanon in 1956, so that he may study and analyze his life, and like a poet praise his fascinating judgments and the scenes of his courageous, you know, encounters in the battlefield, not only when he killed the enemies, even when he restrained himself and was humane and kind to the enemies, and also the interesting incidents of his life. So he's emphasizing the point that if Ali was confined to one era and for one people, why would a person from Lebanon in 1956, from a Christian background, be so much captivated by the life and the thoughts of Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam?
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Classified.
Hello, I'm I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. It's often claimed that the United States and Israel are allies. But what's the reality of their relationship? In today's programme, we'll be examining why, if their connection is so strong, is the Zionist regime involved in espionage against the US? And this espionage even includes spying on presidents of the United States of America. I'll be talking to experts about this after this special report by Latifa Abou-Chakra on how Israel steals secrets from the US.
On the face of it, Israel and the United States couldn't be closer. The Zionist colonization of Palestine could not have been maintained without the $10.4 million a day, $430,000 an hour, $7,229 a minute, and $120 a second that the United States government gives to the temporary entity. However, there is an alternative history that more of us should know. Israel is considered by US intelligence officials to be one of the most aggressive states in launching surveillance operations on US soil, targeting even the very seat of power. Here are some of the most prominent examples of nefarious Israeli information harvesting in the US. US naval intelligence analyst Jonathan Pollard began spying for Israel in 1984. He handed over the National Security Agency's 10-volume manual, which lays out how the US obtains its signal intelligence. He also revealed to Israeli intelligence the names of thousands of US informants. He also propositioned the technical director of the U.S. Navy Ocean Surveillance Information Center, Richard Haver, about giving a back channel to the apartheid regime in South Africa. He was caught by the U.S. government and sentenced to life imprisonment for spying for Israel. It's claimed that Israel attempted to use tapes of former U.S. President Bill Clinton's steamy conversations with intern Monica Lewinsky to leverage the release of Jonathan Pollard. In the year 2000, an article was published by Insight magazine claiming that Israel was able to penetrate four White House telephone lines and relay real-time conversations on those lines from a remote site outside the White House directly to Israel for listening and recording. It's believed that through this setup, Israel obtained knowledge of Bill Clinton's scandalous affair with White House staffer Monica Lewinsky. It is claimed that Netanyahu blackmailed Clinton with this information in an attempt to get the release of Jonathan Pollard. Clinton is said to have been newly impressed with the argument to free Pollard and to have approached CIA Director George Tenet with the issue. However, Tenet threatened to resign if the clemency was granted, with others like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld also standing firmly against the idea. In 2019, figures within the U.S. intelligence community accused Israel of planting cell phone surveillance devices around the White House, known as stingrays. They are believed to look very similar to cell towers and are able to trick cell phones into interacting with them and passing vital information. In 2021, the Associated Press reported that at least 11 U.S. State Department officials had iPhones that had been hacked by Israel's infamous Pegasus spyware. This would have given the NSO group company set up by alumni of Israel's military intelligence unit, 8200, wide access to U.S. government secrets. So as we see here, the United States is a key target for Israeli surveillance operations.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Asa Winstanley. He's an investigative journalist and associate editor with the Electronic Intifada. He also co-hosts the Electronic Intifada podcast and publishes a weekly Substack newsletter called Palestine is Still the Issue. Asa's book, Weaponizing Antisemitism, How the Israel Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn, is due to be published in April. We spoke to him earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, this Jonathan Pollard case seems quite extraordinary, doesn't it?
Well, it is an extraordinary case, his involvement in U.S. intelligence has quite a number of facets to him. He tried to get into the CIA, first of all. They wouldn't have him after he failed the lie detector test. And then naval intelligence couldn't get access to the data from the CIA, but they let him in. Several people inside naval intelligence tried to have him demoted or his security clearance removed, but that didn't really work. And eventually he goes on to give all this material to the Israelis. I mean, stuff, I mean, he claimed it was only stuff which the Americans should have been giving to the Israelis in the first place. But, you know, he gave them all this stuff which you know, was way beyond what was related to Israel. And the names of thousands of assets. So, you know, there's thousands of people in the world, you know, who are assets of US intelligence, including, of course, people in this country who are said in the WikiLeaks famous leaked cables to be strictly protect assets. So the Israelis know the names and identities of all these people and, of course, can then, you know, use that for their own advantage. So there's a huge sense in which there is a compromise of U.S. intelligence. And the fact that people like Rumsfeld, Cheney, the head of the CIA, George Tenet, were saying, absolutely do not let this guy go, is a real indication of the dividing line. I mean, these are people who would normally be instinctively supportive of Israel's foreign policy interests. But in this case, they were absolutely not. This is a red line which we should not cross. A very, very extraordinary case, but not the only one. We've heard about other cases in the film there, but let's remember that the Israelis have got the bomb, the nuclear bomb,
indeed,
because they stole all of the secrets and indeed significant quantities of plutonium directly from the US, and no one was ever held to account for that. Mm. So this is a pattern of hostile activity by a supposed ally inside the US.
Mm. Quite incredible. Well, we asked Asa what Jonathan Pollard's been up to since the US released him from prison.
He was interviewed by the newspaper Israel Hayom, which is this right-wing tabloid in Israel, which is run, funded by now Miriam Adelson, used to be Sheldon Adelson, but he died and his wife inherited his pro-Israel empire. And, you know, she defended him in a column that she has. You know, Pollard has been trying to basically rewrite history, basically, because he said in this interview that, so his Miriam Adelson's newspaper gave him this very sort of fawning interview, like a really puff piece interview, because they'd been campaigning for his release, they'd been calling for his release for a long time, so they're not going to challenge him in this interview. And he said, he claimed that he wasn't all about money, I didn't want any gifts, but, you know, the history of what he actually did was well known, and he was very well compensated for this. But, you know, he was completely unrepentant in that interview. He said that if he was asked by the interviewer, what would you tell young American intelligence officers today, would you switch allegiance to Israel? His response was, I'd tell him, this hypothetical new US traitor for Israel, I'd tell him not doing anything is unacceptable. And he said that just moving to Israel is not acceptable and that it wasn't enough. And he said, you have to make a decision whether your concern for Israel is more important than your life.
David, when you mentioned in your previous answer there that Pollard accessed some very, very sensitive information. I mean, I wonder whether you could say, in your opinion, how that affected the balance of power in the region?
Well, the way in which Mossad operates here is to assume and to treat the US as if it's a hostile power. Now, it's supposed to be an ally, but they treat it differently. Now, there's no allegations, no information that the Jordanians or the Saudis or other Western related intelligence agencies have done the same kind of thing. It's only the Israelis who are doing this. As the film there showed, the Mossad are regarded as being the most aggressive of the foreign intelligence agencies, and it's supposed to be an ally. So this is partly about shifting the balance of power in favour of Israeli interests, even though the Americans are already extremely favourable towards the Israelis, and that it helps to tip the balance against the possibility of any sensible activity in relation to the Palestinian issue, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also asked Asa what he made of the news that Israel was tapping the phones of the White House under both Clinton and Trump.
I didn't find it very surprising at all. I mean, I wasn't surprised, but that's only because I'm familiar with the history of all this. It's something that's always been there, you know. A decade ago, when the Edward Snowden files came out, so Edward Snowden, the former National Security Agency U.S. Intelligence contractor, you know, he was working on state secrets for the United States government, and he became a very brave whistleblower, and he revealed a lot of NSA files about a decade ago to the journalist Glenn Greenwald, and he's now still living in exile in Russia. Those files showed us a tremendous amount of revelations and evidence of a great many things, mass surveillance by the US government on its own civilians, on its own citizens for no justifiable reason, just doing it because they want to have control over the population. But one of the things I found really interesting there was that, I mean, and it wasn't entirely new, but it showed that it was confirmed up until the recent times, is that those files, the Snowden files, showed US counterintelligence considers Israel to be one of its top security threats.
David, this Pegasus software that was used to hack the phones of State Department employees must be pretty sophisticated, mustn't it? I mean, I wonder whether you could say exactly what Pegasus does.
Well, it's been under development since about 2011, so over a decade, and it's been a kind of cat and mouse game whereby it was discovered, I think, first of all in 2013, and then what happens is that the software companies who've made the software which it penetrates then put patches on, so for example, Apple or the Android phones or WhatsApp, and it uses what's called either one-click or zero-click installation, which means that sometimes you would click a link that you're sent by a text message or through your photos or through your music app, or sometimes, you would be called and you wouldn't even have to answer the phone, and the software can install itself and indeed can then cover its tracks and delete itself. So it can access everything on your phone, your passwords, your call history, your position, your text messages, etc. So it's extremely effective at entering your phone and using it to gather all the data that you've got, and you wouldn't even know, and it can cover its tracks so that it's not traceable.
Something incredible. Well, we then asked Asa if he thought there were elements in the US national security state that opposed what Israel's doing, given that, as David has already said, Rumsfeld, Tennant and Cheney were all apparently vehemently opposed to Pollard's release.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. And I think these decisions are quite often made by politicians rather than intelligence operatives. In other words, the pro-Israel decisions, such as Obama's decision to release Pollard, because he'd served 30 years in jail, rightfully so, in my view. But there were still voices saying that he should know it. And this is not Asa Winstanley's voice I'm talking about. I'm not talking about activist voices. I'm talking about voices within the US intelligence so-called community. They always call it the intelligence community. But mainstream American spies, high-level spies, who were saying this man shouldn't be released. There was even senior people saying that he should have been executed because this is high treason what he did. That was the kind of, there's these crazy politicians who say that Julian Assange should have been executed, and he wasn't even a US citizen, and what he did was actually in the public interest, unlike what Jonathan Pollard did. Information on this was military information. This wasn't trying to expose war crimes by the United States. It was quite the opposite. It was trying to allow Israel to carry out war crimes against the Palestinians and against its Arab neighbours.
Well, we'll just pause there for a moment because we've got a report now on how Mossad pressured Bill Clinton to pardon Israeli assets.
It has been established that the Israeli blackmail of Bill Clinton over Monica Lewinsky was not enough to obtain the release of Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard. But did Israeli targeting aid in the official pardoning of two Israeli intelligence assets by Bill Clinton on his last day in office in 2001? Commodities trader Mark Rich and his partner Pinchas Green fled the United States in 1983 before federal charges were filed against them for tax evasion and ripping off U.S. taxpayers to the tune of $48 million. Both of these Israeli intelligence assets were protected for 20 years by the Zionist entity while on the FBI's most wanted list. The Israeli Prime Minister at the time, Ehud Barak, intervened several times to pressure Clinton for the pardon of Rich, citing his contributions to Israel's national security. Former chief of Israel's external intelligence services, Shabtai Shavit, also sent a letter to Clinton arguing that Rich had provided vital assistance to Mossad. Overall, more than 50 prominent Israeli figures sent letters lobbying Clinton to release Rich and his partner Pinchas Green. These included key political and intelligence figures. An Israeli cabinet minister had remarked that Rich and Green had provided information vital in obtaining special strategic supplies during the war against Iraq in 1991, when the Zionist entity faced Iraqi rockets. Rich was also widely credited with personally acting as a frontman for Israeli intelligence non-military operations, not only supplying the funds, but also allowing the branches of his company in the Middle East to be used to gather intelligence and recruit agents for Mossad. Rich was reported by the LA Times to have become a scion for Israeli intelligence. These point men form a security net which can be called on by Israel in emergencies to fulfill unusual assignments. It is known that Bill Clinton's White House phone lines were tapped by Israel at the time, creating significant vulnerabilities. But what about his friendship with sex offender Jeffrey Epstein? Epstein has been described by his former mentor, Stephen Hoffenberg, as boasting about selling secrets of the rich and famous to Mossad. Epstein was also found to have significant business interests with former head of Israeli military intelligence, Ehud Barak. Hoffenberg is quoted as saying that Epstein had a deal with the Israelis to gather intelligence and information from people. Was Bill Clinton also being spied on by Israel through his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein? And if so, was the information obtained used to pressure him to sign off on the pardon of Israeli intelligence assets Mark Rich and Pinchas Green in 2001?
David, what do you know about Mark Rich and Pinchas Green?
So these guys were arrested, or there was an attempt to arrest them, charge them, and they were spirited away in 1983. And the Israelis stopped them being extradited, stopped them coming to justice. And there's a long period of not cooperating with the U.S. authorities. And that the reason for this was because they were assets of Israeli intelligence, that they were using their companies and to allow Mossad to spy and indeed to recruit people, and they were effectively acting as a cover, as a front group for the Mossad to allow them to operate in ways which wouldn't be detected. So this is the kind of thing which Mossad does. This is the kind of thing which most intelligence agencies do, actually. But we know with Mossad that they have been doing this, for example, in the US, which is supposed to be an ally, where they're not supposed to be doing this kind of activity. both Green and Mark Rich were assets of Israeli intelligence, and there are many, many more of those in action all around the world.
Interesting. Well, we asked Asa what kind of reaction there was to Bill Clinton pardoning these two Israeli assets.
I think there was far more questioning of it from what I've seen than there was recently of Pollard's release last year. I mean, Pollard's release last year was a really muted affair. It was barely reported in the West, you know, let alone his interview in the Israeli press where he encouraged further treason by U.S. intelligence officers for Israel. So that wasn't covered at all. But, people did question it. You know, it was regarded as something that, like, why is this happening? Should this really be happening? And, you know, people have questioned whether Bill Clinton was essentially blackmailed by the Israelis into releasing them. And, you know, it's certainly a possibility when we look at all the intelligence connections there.
David, what does this term scion, I mean, what is it? What does it mean?
Scion, or scionim is the collective word for these. These are people who work for Mossad, who are not paid by Mossad. They might be given expenses and given infrastructure to work with for operations, but they're effectively Mossad's little helpers, is the way, one way of putting
right,
it. And they operate all around the world. They're, you know, according to the author Gordon Thomas, I'm not sure you know, the basis of his evidence, but he says there are thousands and thousands of these people, including thousands in this country, in the UK, as well as many more than that in the US. I don't know how accurate that is, but certainly they exist, and certainly Mossad employs them to run errands for them. I mean, we have in previous shows looked, for example, at the case in Morocco where Mossad was involved in spiriting Jewish kids out and then taking them back to Israel to increase the numbers of settlers in the occupied Palestine. And that was done by people who were Sinaiim, including, famously, a guy called David Lippmann and his wife, Giselle, who, of course, is the far-right author, Bat Yor. So we know that this happens and that they're used to kind of magnify the ability of Mossad to operate in places where they don't have many personnel. Mm-hmm. And these guys, Rich and Green, were them too. And they're active everywhere. Now, these are different from the people who they send out as propaganda emissaries for what they call explanation, or hasbara in Hebrew. And they're called shlichim, right? So there are literally thousands of them around the world as well. So they've got intelligence operatives all over the place, and they've also got people doing propaganda and propagandizing for the occupation of Palestine as well.
And David, what did Jeffrey Epstein's mentor, Stephen Hoffenberg, have to say about his activities?
Well, I mean, Hoffenberg has said that Epstein was part of an operation, was working with Mossad, that he did that through, for example, Robert Maxwell and his daughter, Ghislaine Maxwell. And he's not the only person who's made these kind of allegations. Mm. It seems perfectly plain that Epstein was used or was in contact with Mossad, and indeed Maxwell, the whole Maxwell family, it seems, are effectively assets of Israeli intelligence. Jalene's brothers and sister. It's pretty clear now, I think, that what was going on here was that Epstein was using the knowledge that he got from his various abusive relationships, including the trafficking of minors to celebrities, so that he could then pressure them. He was in contact with Mossad. Clearly, Mossad were using this to pursue their own interests. We don't know the full extent of this, but it's pretty plain now that there was a Mossad role here, and that's why there's such a lot of intrigue in relation to this.
Interesting, yeah, really very interesting. And that's not something that's not really come out, other than probably on this show. But anyway, finally, I just wanted to ask you, David, about Epstein's friendship with Clinton. I mean, I think from what you said there, I mean, it's been pretty significant in this whole affair, hasn't it?
Well, I mean, you don't want to overemphasize personal relationships and operations by intelligence agencies over the kind of broader interests of domestic and foreign policy. But certainly, we know from everything we know about these kinds of networks, they are and can be influential. So the friendship with Clinton, of course, is important and should be looked into. But it's really very evident that large numbers of very powerful individuals in the public eye, from royalty in this country to politicians to business people, had contact with Epstein and were involved to a greater or lesser degree in the abuse of minors as part of his operation. And so we shouldn't be surprised to have questions raised about what kind of influence that gives our foreign intelligence services like Mossad, who had the connections with him.
Yeah, certainly poses some questions. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time again today. I hope you've found the programme informative. Thanks to our guests, Aiswin Stanley, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The killing of black Americans or African Americans by U.S. police has been highlighted by U.S. media in recent years. These killings have become so normal that it seems Americans have accepted it because there is no police accountability in the United States. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. A new data analysis reveals U.S. law enforcement killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the United States since experts first started tracking the killings. According to Mapping Police Violence, police across the country killed an average of more than 3 people a day, or nearly 100 people every month last year. The non-profit research group maintains a database of reported deaths at the hands of law enforcement, including people fatally shot by police, beaten or restrained or tasered. In 2021, police officers killed 1,145 people. 1,152 were killed in 2020. 1,097 individuals were killed by U.S. law enforcement in 2019. 1,140 were killed in 2018. And 1,089 were killed in 2017. The earliest data goes back to 2013, when advocates began counting these fatal incidents. A database run by the Washington Post, which tracks fatal shootings by police officers, also shows 2022 as a year with record killings. The data release comes 2 years after the murder of George Floyd sparked national uprising calling for racial justice, police accountability, and reductions in funding and size of police forces throughout the United States. Despite the international attention and some local efforts to curb police brutality, there has been an intensifying backlash to criminal justice reform, and the overall number of killings has remained alarmingly high. Bianca Austin, the aunt of Breonna Taylor, whose March 2020 killing in Kentucky sparked mass protests throughout the United States, said, "It just never stops. There was a movement and uproar across the globe, and we're still having more killings. What are we doing wrong? It's so disheartening." While the numbers have crept up, the circumstances that precede the killings have remained consistent. In 2022, 132 killings, or 11% of the total, were cases in which no offence was alleged. 104 cases, or 9% of the total, were mental health or welfare checks. 98 cases, or 8% of the total, involved traffic violations. 207 cases, or 18% of the total, involved other allegations of non-violent offences. There were also 93 cases, or 8% of the total, involving claims of a domestic disturbance. And 128 cases, or 11% of the total, where the person was allegedly seen with a weapon. Only 370 cases, or 31% of the total, involved a potentially more serious situation with an alleged violent crime. Samuel Sinyangwe, a data scientist and policy analyst who founded Mapping Police Violence and provided 2022 data to The Guardian, said, "These are routine police encounters that escalate to a killing. The reduction in the conversation around police violence does not mean that this issue is going away. What's clear is that it's continuing to get worse and that it is deeply systemic." The Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. At least 1,176 people were killed by law enforcement officers in the United States last year, the most of any year since at least 2013. According to the non-profit organization Mapping Police Violence, which last updated its database on 31st of December 2022, that's 36 more people than in 2021. It may be an undercount as the organization continues to compile data, which it does regularly for all of the years it tracks. Of people killed by law enforcement last year, 287 were African Americans. The group found that 24% of the total number of police killings. U.S. Census data shows 13.6% of the population of the United States is black. Police shooting incidents accounted for 96% of the killings. The database also tracks killings by taser, vehicles, or other use of force. Native American and Pacific Islander populations were almost disproportionately affected by police violence. Calls to reform or defund police departments have grown from activists and protesters in past years, particularly in the wake of the May 2020 murder of George Floyd, an African-American man, by a white police officer. That year's Black Lives Matter protests are believed to be the largest movement in U.S. history, and international protests also decried anti-black police brutality. The 50 largest cities in the United States reduced their fiscal 2021 police budgets by 5.2% from the year prior in aggregate. But police funding also comprised a slightly higher percentage of the overall budgets. A Bloomberg analysis showed cities including Tampa, Florida, Phoenix, Arizona, increased their police funding in fiscal year 2021. New York and Minneapolis were among those cities that decreased their budgets that year. New York allocated $5.53 billion towards police spending in fiscal year 2023. In May of 2022, on the second anniversary of George Floyd's murder by a white police officer, President Joe Biden signed an executive order addressing police accountability. It included new policies on chokeholds and anti-bias training to fight racism within law enforcement. Mapping Police Violence found that 98.1% of police killings since 2013 have resulted in no police accountability. The database also examined the situation surrounding each killing, with at least a third occurring when the person did not present a threat to police officers. It stated, "One in every three people killed by police officers was running away, driving away, or otherwise trying to flee the scene. Black and brown people were more likely to be killed whilst fleeing." The Washington Post has also covered the same story. In 32% of cases of police killings last year, the person was fleeing before they were killed, generally running away or driving off, cases in which experts say lethal force is unwarranted and also endangers the public. In June, Ohio police officers fired dozens of rounds at Jaylen Walker, who was unarmed and fleeing. Just a month later, a police officer in California exited an unmarked car and immediately fired at Robert Adams as he ran in the opposite direction. The racial disparities have also persisted. Black people were 24% of those killed last year, while making up only 13% of the U.S. population. From 2013 to 2022, black residents were three times more likely to be killed by a police officer than white residents. The inequality is particularly severe in some cities, including Minneapolis, where police officers have killed black residents at a rate of 28 times higher than those of white residents, and Chicago, Illinois, where the rate was 25 times higher for blacks compared to whites. Jacob Blake Sr., whose son was shot by Kenosha police and left paralyzed in 2020, said, "Police's ability to be judge, jury, and executioner has been taken to another level. No matter how much we insist that it's wrong, society allows it to take place." Jacob Blake Sr. and Bianca Austin, aunt of Breonna Taylor, whose March 2020 killing in Kentucky sparked mass protests throughout the United States, run a group called Families United that assists people whose loved ones have been killed by police officers. Samuel Sinyangwe, the founder of Mapping Police Violence, also found that there had been a notable uptick in killings by sheriff's departments, which are generally county agencies run by their elected leader. In 2022, sheriffs were involved in 416 killings in the United States, higher than the share in 2013, which was 277 cases. It's unclear what's driving that increase, though Samuel Sinyangwe said there had been growing partnerships between sheriffs and other agencies, with sheriff deputies executing search warrants or doing chases that can result in death. He said sheriff's officers are also particularly politicized during elections, which could contribute to the problem. Samuel Sinyangwe added, "There are campaigns in which there's a race to the bottom to compete to be more tough on crime, and the result is more violent sheriff's departments."
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. One of the key concepts of a humanity, or the human being in general, is to preserve his dignity and to preserve his essence, because we said, you know, what makes a human person or human being a human or a person is the fact that he preserves his dignity and everything else around it, all the other rights, all other human rights are in fact trying to preserve that human dignity. We understand that the human being has two dimensions. He has a materialistic dimension and he has a spiritual dimension. And we can submit to the fact that human being, or the human being himself, is a very complicated creature. Absolutely complicated. So it is very hard to judge such a creature with certainty. And from here we can understand why people of theology or philosophy or those who are trying to put laws, they never got it right, or they always keep, you know, having this moral dilemma: where should we do this, and should we do that? If we do this, what happens to that? There's constant trouble or constant, you know, fight within those who are trying to, you know, write the laws for mankind. So one of the things that we ask in regards to the human dignity, and obviously his basic right, is when we look at punishments, or as we call them in Islam, retributions, iqab, or qisas, to be precise. Are those punishments suitable for the human being? In a way, it does not override or violates his dignity. Be it retribution, Islamic retribution, or be it, you know, punishment by the law. And what is the relationship between punishment and retribution and the human dignity? When we look at the human-made systems that we have today, and that we most, if not actually all, I should all say, all governments are bound by, we see them when it comes to the concept of punishment and the human dignity, we see them colliding in a sense where there are a lot of punishment written by man that actually takes the right of a person and they are not befitting for him. Such laws, I mean, I could sit here for days and days trying to go through the unfair, unjust laws that human beings have to face as a punishment for actions or acts that it does not fit the crime, does not fit the punishment, or the punishment does not fit the crime, which in fact ends up doing what? Taking the human dignity away, or trying to at least attack the human dignity. When we look at the human being, we have to make sure that we come up with a punishment suitable for him. And the question is, who can come up with a law that is suitable with the human being in a sense or in a way where it does not collide with his human dignity, where it does not take his rights away? I mean, not a person that does something really stupid and then he ends up being imprisoned for many years or at least punished for something that's, you know, ridiculous. Let us take a short break and then we will look at that.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about punishment and human dignity. We said who can come up with a law or a punishment or retribution that is suitable
for the human being. In a way, it does not take or deprive him of his dignity. And the short answer is obviously Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Since we said human beings are very complicated humans and they're very special in their own way and they're very unique. So the one that needs to put a system of punishment or retribution, it has to be the maker himself. Why? Because the maker himself, he knows those human beings because he created them. Therefore, he knows what's good for them, what's bad for them. And when he places retributions, he knows that this is fitting for them or not fitting for them. It will hurt them or their dignity or not hurt them, right? So obviously, it's God's law. And God's law today is summarized in one word, and that is Islam. When we look at the Islamic retributions, we see it does not collide with the human dignity, unlike the man-made laws. Because Islam takes everything into perspective. For example, to make it much easier, much understandable. In a system, or at least in a country, where there's poverty, if a person tries to, I don't know, steal a loaf of bread to feed his family, he will be caught by the police and he will be labeled as a thief and he might be imprisoned for trying to survive. In an Islamic world, or in a world where it is governed by an Islamic law, they don't do that. We don't label him as a thief. We look at the circumstances. Why did the person have to do what he has to do? Is it out of need? Out of necessity, out of survival, or not, then the retribution or punishment comes into play. Sometimes you'll find out in Islamic laws that the society should be punished, not the person, because the person is only in the state that he's in, and he committed what he committed because the society neglected his rights. So we see, for example, Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, and other imams, as I've read in their stories, that when they look at workers, they said, have they been paid up front? Have their wages been set for them? Did you pay them? And sometimes they say, no, we will pay them later. He says, no, you shouldn't do that. You should give them their money up front. Because it's trying to preserve that human dignity, not take it away. So here is a dilemma that we fall in, that these laws that we have, they're always colliding with the human dignity. In Islam, I mean, the harshest punishment that we have is death. And death is only when a person violates the rights of other people by taking either their life or doing something that takes their dignity. For example, committing adultery, a married man or a married woman with one another. When a person's dignity and a person's right is being taken, then Allah says, you are no longer deserving of having yours. Therefore, we need to take it away. So only Islam can preserve the human rights and human dignity through the laws that he places when it comes to punishment and retributions. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is
parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.